Coming up on Simply Superior.
Simply Superior, news and issues from a superior point of view.
Homelessness is rising in the Twin Ports.
It's cold and I'm nowhere to sleep.
What are the reasons, and are practical solutions possible?
What we're seeing now is increased numbers of persons living in places that are unfit for human habitation.
We'll hear from those who know it best. Plus, move over, Highwaymen, and Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. The Twin Ports has its own supergroup.
Time can be so callous.
Yeah, I managed to pull together a pretty stellar team of players and collaborators and artists.
We'll catch up with Sarah Kruger and Lanou after this.
Singing with a crow.
Simply superior news and issues from a superior point of view.
Homelessness is rising in the Twin Ports.
It's cold and I'm nowhere to sleep.
What are the reasons, and are practical solutions possible?
What we're seeing now is increased numbers of persons living in places that are unfit for human habitation.
We'll hear from those who know it best. Plus, move over, Highwaymen, and Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. The Twin Ports has its own supergroup.
Time can be so callous.
Yeah, I managed to pull together a pretty stellar team of players and collaborators and artists.
We'll catch up with Sarah Kruger and Lanou.
Singing with a crow.
Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. We'll hear more from Sarah Kruger and Lanou later in the show. But first, a special on homelessness heard on most of our regional stations earlier this year. Homelessness is one of the most persistent problems in our society, and after a significant decline 10 years ago, it's on the rise again. The website homelessness.org counts 580,000 people nationwide experiencing homelessness, considerably less than over 600,000 a decade ago, but up by more than 30,000 individuals in the last 2 years. And if you think it's just a problem affecting urban areas, it isn't. There's rural homelessness, and even a small city like Superior has an encampment under a bridge on Belknap Avenue. All of this may be becoming more visible because those encampments are increasingly colorful, thanks to tents from manufacturers like the North Face and REI. I've noticed exactly that. And our guests will tell us if it's just because I've been paying more attention or that the nature of homelessness has changed, specifically the reasons why people may live in an encampment instead of seeking other means of shelter and survival. Joining us are two experts very familiar with those issues, Chris Herring, an assistant professor of sociology at the University of California at Los Angeles and a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard University. Welcome to Simply Superior, Professor Herring.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
And John Cole, the executive director of CHUM, operators of the Twin Ports' largest food shelf and emergency shelter, and more broadly, the area's primary safety net organization for people who are experiencing homelessness. Welcome, John Cole.
Thank you, Robin. It's good to be here and be part of this conversation.
So first, John, can you give us a lay of the land locally and tell us exactly who are the people experiencing homelessness in our area?
Well, when we focus here in Duluth and Superior and in the Twin Ports, we see that we have an increasing problem. Within St. Louis County, homelessness has increased over the last 13 years by 22%. And what we're seeing now is increased numbers of persons who are turning to our shelters and also increased numbers of persons who are living in places that are unfit for human habitation. They're in encampments, in the woods, they're on the highways, and in any place that provides some sort of shelter for them. This has been driven, of course, by economic situations, the fact that we are experiencing a housing crisis here, in our area, that's making affordable housing being very scarce and also priced beyond the means of regular low-income workers. And the problem is even more exacerbated by the prevalence of mental health concerns as well as chemical and substance use.
Chris Herring, how does what John described reflect national trends? And I know you've done particular work on the West Coast.
Yes, the description fits broadly. I would just say that this growth over a decade that John mentions, is very different in different parts of the country. And so, as you mentioned at the top of the show, that there was a recent increase in the last 2 years, this is almost completely driven by growth of homelessness in the West Coast, in places like California and often very big cities. And we continue to see actually a reduction of homelessness over the last decade in many other areas. However, in the West Coast, and it sounds like in your community, there are still growth. It's driven increasingly by housing unaffordability. We see that in areas where housing becomes less affordable, we see the greatest growth in homelessness. And areas here out west, as well as where John mentioned, we're still experiencing cuts to mental health care and challenges such as the overdose crisis, which we hear affecting lots of communities beyond those who are just experiencing housing precarity on the rise, especially during this pandemic, which exacerbates these issues. I guess the last thing I would mention is that family homelessness and families facing evictions has been growing, especially over the last decade. And this is also a very form of hidden homelessness where you have families, you know, doubling up in different areas, which we don't count in the numbers you mentioned, or sleeping in their vehicles and trying to stay out of sight.
You know, piggybacking off of that, actually, you mentioned housing prices. We've had a huge increase in housing prices in both Duluth and Superior, thanks to the pandemic, because people now can work remotely. We have a beautiful area, Chris. When you come visit us, you'll agree. And unfortunately, people from larger areas, fortunately and unfortunately, have found that now that they can do their work remotely, they can do it in Duluth and Superior and pay less than they would for a house in the Twin Cities, but a lot more than our people have been paying for houses. Hence, our prices have gone up. And even if the numbers aren't in yet of the rise of homelessness during the pandemic, I would suspect we're going to see that rise. John, more than a decade ago, I spoke to your predecessors about what were then viewed as intractable reasons for homelessness. One mantra that was often repeated was that nobody wants to live outside, or particularly in our area, or be without a home. And I challenged that because there was at least one person in the area who lived in what could best be described as an igloo that was actually quite cozy and protected from the elements, because she in no way wanted to be subject to what she viewed as real, and I think she experienced as real, dangers at shelters. Has that thinking changed today about whether anybody would choose to, you know, not be in a traditional home?
That has not changed in the way that you're thinking. I think everyone wants a home, but there are reasons why persons would find themselves out in the street or in an encampment away from a home. You would find that with the chemical addiction and the mental health issues, that you have persons who, because of the paranoia, would not feel comfortable around other persons. So would be avoiding shelter settings and would rather stay outdoors, and will do so as long as it's possible. When winter comes around, then they'll take refuge in warming shelters. There are folks, though, because of their mental impairment, have these barriers that prevent them from engaging with the services that are there to help them, and needs considerable outreach to bridge that and to be able to connect them so that they can begin to access the available services and begin perhaps that transition from being in encampments or living outdoors in unsafe situations to congregate settings or even to being housed. But it is a considerable process for folks to be able to make that sort of move. So yeah, it's a mixed bag of folks who do not want to live indoors and those who cannot because of the impairment and would need considerable help in helping them to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with John Cole, the executive director of CHUM, operators of the Twin Ports largest food shelf and emergency shelter, and Chris Herring, assistant professor of sociology at the University of California, Los Angeles, and a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard University. Chris Herring, you've done extensive studies of tent encampments, and I have a theory that I want you to either stand up or knock down. I used to visit San Francisco yearly, and I certainly noticed homelessness out there, but I noticed it far more pronounced after not having visited for about 5 years. And what I saw that I hadn't seen before was people living in camping tents, such as from REI or the North Face, and these have popped up around the country. There's a study of yours, by the way, in which you quote a person experiencing homelessness saying, "When I first became homeless, it drove me crazy, being out in public in parks or cafes all day, and then coming back to the shelter to sleep in public with no privacy. When I zip up my tent, I can read, watch a movie, do whatever. I can store my things here so I don't have to lug around a cart of stuff all day, and I know it's safe. It's my last piece of space, and the shelter doesn't give you that," close quote. So my theory is that these tents are now far better at protecting you from the elements than before. The rating of, 20 below or whatever is increased, and actually offer amenities, if you will, that shelters such as CHUM can't. So am I right in that observation or totally wrong?
Yeah, I think there's two parts of this issue. One is, has there been an increase or a growth of the use of tents? And then there are the reasons of why people might prefer that to other alternatives. So on the first issue, you can look at photos back in the 1930s where people are constructing tents. And, even in the early 2000s and late 90s, which I imagine is before you were speaking, unhoused folks were using tents for shelter then. And in fact, depending on when you visited for this conference, San Francisco had a boost in 2019, but it didn't experience these large growth in the raw numbers. But there was a visual change in the homelessness we were seeing in that city. And people who were more hidden in the city and could camp out in less visible areas, industrialized areas, away from residences or workplaces, just weren't seen. And so folks who used to be hidden, people will call the cops on them and they will move in and they're filling up this part of the city where when you go and visit as a tourist or at your conference, it's much more visible on the sidewalks rather than on the margins. So I think it's important to, think about how, in this case, the enforcement of where you can and cannot be is really driving what we're seeing rather than necessarily, although in many places it is true, an absolute growth in homelessness. The second piece is, why would someone prefer to be be outside rather than in a shelter? On the West Coast and in some cities, it's very different than others. So, in San Francisco, where we in our last count, we had about 9,000 unhoused folks, only 38% of those were sheltered in some sort of temporary shelter. And before the pandemic, there was actually a wait list for that. So there were over 1,000 people waiting to get shelter, which would typically take 5 weeks. Or you could wait in line for a single night bed, which would often be hours waiting outside just to get a bed in one of these congregate shelters. And even if you got one of these reserve beds, after 90 days, you would have to leave and then get back on the list or do the one night bed. And this is how it is in many large West Coast cities and other cities where there's not, as in, say, New York City, a right to shelter, or in very cold places where it's very clearly a humanitarian issue of getting people out of the cold and into shelter. And so there's actually far greater demand for people to get into shelter who can't. And so it's not even a choice or a preference for some folks. Now, that being said, there are plenty of folks. I spent 57 nights out on the street with folks camping out in San Francisco and hundreds of days. And this is where one of these quotes come from. And during that time, there are many things I preferred of being outside, considering the situation of most of the shelters, which was, you know, definitely the lack of privacy. But, you know, some people who want the safety and shelter will obviously prefer shelter to being outside. There are different dangers. Some people who were more fit and stronger, and this also plays into gender dynamics, felt safer outside with a group of people where they could protect their belongings versus inside where things would often get stolen. And there were violence in both spaces. There were health risks of both places. You were definitely more likely to catch a cold or a sickness when I was staying in shelter, not to mention now with the situation of COVID, which have really had huge outbreaks. We just had yesterday a shelter with the Omicron going through San Francisco, where more than half of the shelter residents tested positive. Very difficult. But even before that, I'd often catch things in a shelter more often than outside. Of course, outside, you have the elements, which you're trying to protect yourself from, which, of course, is the use of the tent. Shelters, many cities have curfews where you have to be inside. For some people who are recycling or working night shifts, it doesn't work with their job. Most shelters close down during the day, so even if you have a place to sleep at night, you have no place to be during the day. Whereas if you have a camp in a community, you have that space. So I think it's important. I don't know that we can hear more from John of the situation of the shelter there. But as we hear about this in different countries, it's really important to recognize what shelters do and do not offer. And also that it's often the case that shelter is simply not available or accessible to people.
I could follow up on that in terms of the unavailability. You know, homelessness is one of the things is a failure of public and private support systems. And so what we have, unsheltered homelessness has increased by 37% in our county. And that means that our shelter capacity is inadequate, woefully inadequate. We probably have 255 beds, whereas the unsheltered population is over 600. So right away, we have an excess of demand for shelter units. And so folks are forced to be outside or to sleep in the vehicles and or to use tents to survive, whereas they would have rather been in shelter. Though my shelter is open 24/7, and folks are welcome to spend time there. There's a lot of issues of privacy. For folks who have agoraphobia and cannot be around folks, it becomes an issue. For folks who have paranoia and a failure system, it becomes an issue. And so they would rather stay outside than being in. But when you think of the fact that 47% of the year, our temperatures is under freezing.
Well, freezing is considered warm for us. Freezing
I
is
know,
only 32,
yes,
32
I know.
Above.
Yes, yes, yes. Remember, I'm still new to the area, so I'm getting acclimated. But, you know, it becomes a natural incentive for folks to come in. And that's why we operate the warming shelters as well between November and April. And there we will see a large influx of persons coming in who would have otherwise for the rest of the year will be outside. And it is a quite incredible mix of behavioral issues and mental health and chemical addiction issues and challenges that are presented as we try to save persons from the elements.
We're speaking with John Cole, the executive director of CHUM in Duluth, and Chris Herring of the University of California at Los Angeles and a Harvard University postdoctoral fellow. We're talking about homelessness and the increase we've seen locally and national trends as well. I'm Robin Washington. We'll continue our discussion and check in with the music of Sarah Kruger and Lanou after this.
You got a fast car. I got a plan to get us out of here. Been working at the convenience store.
Managed to save just a little bit of money. Won't have to drive too far. Just cross the border and into the city. You and I can both get jobs and finally see what it means to be living. See, my old man's got a problem. Yeah, but the bottle, that's the way it is. He says his body's too old for working. His body's too young to look like his. My mama went off and left him. She wanted more from life than he could give. I said, somebody's got to take care of him. I had a feeling that I belong. I had a feeling I could be someone, be someone, be someone.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. We continue with our discussion of homelessness in the Twin Ports and beyond, and in particular, its rise in recent years. That includes the proliferation of tent encampments in cities around the country, including right here in Superior. We'll rejoin our guests in a moment, but first, Wisconsin Public Radio News Superior-based reporter Danielle Kading is here to tell us about the problem locally and resources that might help in northwestern Wisconsin. Danny?
Yeah, in northwestern Wisconsin, you know, for example, we have a homeless encampment in Superior underneath the viaduct that connects the city to the Bong Bridge. And this year, the Superior Telegram has been reporting on some of the issues that they've seen with that. And Mayor Jim Payne said that the encampment grew this year for a number of reasons. You know, he cited some people who have either lost work due to shutdowns during the COVID-19 pandemic, or other camping sites in Duluth that are no longer available that are drawing people to this one. And Mayor Payne also cited, you know, the number of construction workers that we've seen, you know, has increased demand for hotel rooms across the city, and some of which have been used in the past to house homeless residents. And Millie Roundsville with the Northwest Wisconsin Community Services Agency told the Superior City Council about some of the programs they have available to help people who are facing homelessness. And she said that right now they have almost 140 people on a list across their 5-county service area who are homeless and are prioritized for housing right now. And during the pandemic, the agency has awarded $750,000 in payments to landlords to help keep people in their homes through the Wisconsin Emergency Rental Assistance Program because of the challenges that we've seen during the pandemic. And in Ashland, Roundsville said there are plans underway to open the city's first homeless shelter in the former Ashland Motel along Highway 2 sometime early this year. And the Red Cliff Reservation began offering a warming shelter in the last month or so for their residents who are homeless.
That was Wisconsin Public Radio News Superior-based reporter Danielle Kading. Let's go back now to our guests, John Cole, the executive director of CHUM, the area's largest food shelf, emergency shelter, and warming shelter, as he told us just before the break, and Professor Chris Herring of the University of California, Los Angeles, and a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard University. John, Danny just mentioned the Northwest Wisconsin Community Service Agency, and I should point out you can reach them at 715-392-5127. Once again, that's 715-392-5127. How can people get help from CHUM?
102 West 2nd Street in Duluth. That is CHUM's main address. That is where persons can access the emergency shelter, emergency family shelter, and the drop-in shelter. And also, when it comes to the warming center, currently we are operating from the Rainbow Center in Duluth, and folks are able to go there. That's 211 North 3rd Avenue East. Folks are able to go there and be warm and have shelter between 8 p.m. and 8 a.m. in the morning.
Great. So Superior may be an exception, as Danny mentioned briefly, but as a rule, municipalities are not big fans of the encampments we've been speaking of. But shutting them down, you know, may not only be cruel and heartless, but futile. What are authorities getting wrong?
I think what the authorities are missing is the fact that there's a greater cost to the community. by allowing the situation to persist as it is, with persons camping indiscriminately, creating health problems, and racking up costs every time emergency services has to respond, whether it be law enforcement or health services, to respond to situations. There's a huge amount of funds being expended that way that could be better utilized if safe spaces were provided for persons who are staying outdoors, whereby they could exist in safety and also have access. They could be located so that health services, et cetera, could be able to provide the necessary support that persons living outside need.
Mm-hmm. Chris, have you seen any municipality maybe find a better approach?
Yeah, there are some new experiments in responding to homelessness, diverting calls from 911, particularly since the murder of George Floyd, which raised the question of how we might respond to some things such as mental health or homelessness without a police response. One model that is often being looked at and used now in other cities is called Cahoots in Eugene, Oregon, where it first began. The idea there is that when someone calls about a homeless issue because someone's camping or sitting on a sidewalk, which have local ordinances banning, rather than the dispatcher sending that to a police officer who will in most cases just move a person along, so they'll end up being in another area in public space, to send out a social worker either with the police officer or sometimes the social worker will go out first, and if there's some danger, they'll call on the police officer, and then work with the individual in a way that won't involve the criminal justice system. The limits to that, again, is, as we've already spoken of, what resources are available. There have been efforts to link having spaces open when they're going to go in and clear an encampment. But as I mentioned, in these places where there's already a wait list, you're basically pushing someone back who's voluntarily seeking these places, in order to offer them something through what is often a complaint-driven system where you have an encampment that a business improvement district doesn't like. And so if we're not creating more resources and widening the pie, you're essentially just, you know, reshuffling the deck chairs.
Mm-hmm. Does that imply that the encampments might be permanent?
I think it's entirely a political decision, and I'll let John speak to the local issue there of what he thinks might improve the situation. But, you know, take at the beginning of COVID in San Francisco, we opened up a number of hotels which weren't being used to bring people inside, unhouse folks. I always point to other countries, and most other countries, including even very capitalist ones, even the UK, it does a much better job at this. We are really unique. And if the resources were put in place and the political will was there, this is certainly an issue that can be solved.
I like the way you turn what I thought was a terribly negative and dire prediction into something more positive. John, maybe you could bring us back to the reality. Locally, what are the best case and worst case scenarios? Why don't you do worst first so we can end on a positive note?
I think on the housing crisis is the largest challenge. To be able to create affordable housing units in this market, it's incredibly challenging. And I think that's a ways out. And in the meantime, what we have is over 1,300 persons on our coordinated entry waiting list looking for housing opportunities. And you can wait for up to 2 years. And that's the stark reality. So what's happening in the meantime, though, is that the shelter providers have unified persons, all of those services that are offering assistance to persons experiencing homelessness have unified. And we have a 5-year plan, which is designed to create a conduit for persons who are living outside, starting off with safe living spaces, increasing shelter capacity, and then creating 200 low-cost tiny homes that will then create this conduit that allow persons to move from being outside to shelter or to those transformational housing tiny home units. And this plan has been promoted now vigorously by myself and other shelter providers. And we have started conversation with county and city and with the business sector in trying to get this to be something that could offer intervention into this crisis situation.
Great. We've been speaking with Chris Herring, Assistant Professor of Sociology at the University of California, Los Angeles, and a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard University, and John Cole, Executive Director of CHUM, operators of the Twin Ports' largest food shelf, emergency shelter, and warming shelters. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you. Good to be here. Thank you.
Coming up, the music of Sarah Kruger and La Nu.
All I see is blue.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Popular music has seen a number of supergroups throughout the years. They're defined as bands composed of members of other bands, like Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, The Highwaymen, or anything with Eric Clapton or Ginger Baker in it. They might get together for a single album or an off-and-on-again collaboration. Well, the latest entry comes from our region, with a grouping of musicians affiliated with some of Wisconsin and Minnesota's biggest acts, including Bon Iver, Low, and Trampled by Turtles, to say nothing of Taylor Swift, though she hails from Pennsylvania. Their name and that of their debut album is La Nu, and the vocalist is Eau Claire bred and Twin Ports resident Sarah Kruger. I spoke with her last August about the group. Here's our conversation. Welcome to Simply Superior, Sarah Kruger.
Thanks for having me.
You know, we have been Facebook friends forever, actually, since 2012. I just looked it up. I actually had confused you with another Sarah, who has a white tiger as her profile picture, which confuses it even more.
Sounds like it.
So I'm envisioning you, or I was, as a white tiger, but that one's not you, right?
Not me, but I enjoy the visual for sure.
So what animal would you post if you were to do an animal for?
Probably a red fox.
Ah.
Okay. I do like foxes. Yeah.
So anyway, none of those are you. Tell us about the group, which has been described as a super group. You've stolen players, borrowed or acquired from Bon Iver, from Lowell, from Trampled by Turtles, and someone even played with Taylor Swift. So pronounce the name for us. Tell us who all those people are.
Sure. So this latest project of mine is called La Nu, L-A-N-U-E. And these songs were recorded before the pandemic and released this past March. And yeah, I managed to pull together a pretty stellar team of players and collaborators and artists, and they helped me flesh out these songs and bring them to life.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like the Twin Ports or Minnesota, Wisconsin version of Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. And tell us who exactly they are.
Yeah. Sure. You know, this project is kind of fluid. The folks that played on the record, let's start with Sean Carey. He's Eau Claire based, and he played piano and sang and helped with post-production stuff. And then Steve Garrington is based in St. Paul, and he played bass guitar and also helped with the studio production.
And each of those is normally with whom?
Sean has his own project called S. Carey and also plays drums in Bon Iver. And Steve just left a band called Low. And he plays with, a lot of different, he's a wonderful bass player. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then I had JT Bates drumming, and he is probably one of my favorite drummers. He's a wonderful guy. Great drummer. And you mentioned, he did drum on Taylor Swift's latest record, which is kind of neat. But he plays all around with many groups. I think he was just on the Colbert Show, actually. And then, let's see, who else? Ryan Young played the string parts on a handful of the songs, and he is the fiddle player with Trampled by Turtles. And then Eric Koskinen also plays some guitar on most of the songs too, and he's a wonderful musician himself. So yeah, so it was a really great crew that I got to work with, and we recorded down in Eau Claire at Hive, which is Brian Joseph's studio, and it was a lovely experience. And I think that the songs really speak to that space, and you know, no one had a chance to even hear these songs before we got together, and we just kind of let them fold as a group in that space. And I'm really happy with how the record turned out. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So Lanu is the album name, group name, both?
Lanu is the, I would call it the project name.
And I'll pronounce it Lanu, okay.
Lanu, yeah, I would call it the project name. And it's also a self-titled album. And some might say it's maybe my new moniker. I will perform these songs under this name. And, you know, I'm working on some more recording right now, and I'll release those under Lanu as well. So I kind of felt like it had been so long since I had released music under my name, Sarah Kruger. And I sort of wanted a fresh start, and these songs felt like they kind of arrived at a, I would say, more mature place. And I sort of wanted to just detach myself a little bit from my previous work that I had put out so many years ago.
And Lanu means what?
It's a title of a poem by Alan Seeger. And I kept coming back to that poem. You know, every couple of years I would open it up. I always found it to be really beautiful, and the meaning of it kind of changed as I changed. And I liked the idea of a text changing over time and being interpreted by the reader, and taken, you take something different away from a text or from a song than the person next to you does. And I think that that was a important idea, especially in songwriting.
Well, you know what? Through the magic of the internet, we can bring it to you right here. Oft when sweet music undulated round, like the full moon out of a perfumed sea, thine image from the waves of a blissful sound rose in thy sudden light, illumine me.
Yeah.
All right. We'll stop there.
Mm-hmm.
And that is by Alan Seeger, who I understand is a relative of Pete Seeger, or was a relative of Pete Seeger.
Yeah. I believe that's true. Yep.
We are speaking to Sarah Kruger of Lanu. You're from Eau Claire. Then what?
Yeah, I grew up in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and, you know, grew up listening to John Prine and Dylan and all the classics, and graduated from North High School and found my way to Duluth shortly after that. And I've been in Duluth ever since. One thing I love about both Eau Claire and Duluth, I think both Eau Claire and Duluth welcome younger artists with open arms and kind of accept everyone where they're at in order to help them grow into themselves. That's really, I think, something that's special.
Not to mention Superior, which you have to drive through on the way from Eau Claire to Duluth, right?
Yep. Right.
And you can stop there, too. And, of course, I know you performed there, too.
Yeah.
So let's hear something of a performance. I don't know. What speaks to what we've been talking about?
One song that I think has been resonating, the song called What I Love the Most. And that song comes from a place of realizing you have resentful feelings toward things you love because things are so multidimensional, whether it's a relationship or growing a garden or being a parent or what have you, and working through those emotions to kind of keep what's most important at the forefront, which is, you know, your love for that thing, that person. Yeah.
All right. Here's What I Love Most by our guest, Sarah Kruger, AKA performing with all of the above, Lanu.
Thank you.
sit out in the garden, singing with the crows. I'll find you at the river, bound to the shore. Your hands under the water, forget you wanted more. Some days I'm a murderer, some days I'm a ghost. Some days I spend all my time hating what I love the most. Some days I'm a murderer, some days I'm a ghost. Some days I spend all my time hating what I love. Saw a velvet lining behind your champagne eyes. Some days I'm a martyr, some days I'm a ghost. Some days I spend all my time hating what I love the most. Some days I'm a martyr, some days.
And that's What I Love Most by Sarah Kruger, as performing with or being a part of or one and the same as Lanou. Maybe more than local. You've been playing in the Twin Cities, places like, what, First Avenue, I'm told. And you're doing the State Fair. You're getting some national press. We going to lose you?
No, I think I'm here to stay. I love this place. I love where I live and I love this community.
All right. Well, we're going to hold you too.
Yeah.
But you can travel all over the place to perform because we want to share you with the world. And I think that one reason you do love this place is the environment. You've written about that, so that's not a big secret.
Right.
And a song that speaks to that?
Sure. I think maybe the song July. Essentially, the song is about swimming in Lake Superior, which sounds so simple, but
oh yeah, but those of us who have tried,
it's
find out that 40 degree water in July is a surprise. Yes,
I think it's practice in reminding yourself that you're alive and connected to something bigger. And
and you can't control it as much as you think. Yes.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Yep.
All right, well, let's listen to July by our guest Sarah Kruger, singing and performing and being a part of La Nu. And that was July, although this is August, by our guest Sarah Kruger, performing as, singing with the group La Nu. And where can we find more information?
Yeah, I would head to lanumusic.com, and that gives you all the info about shows and how to listen and buy and support and watch videos and all that good stuff.
Great. And that is spelled L-A-N-U-E, music.
You got it.
How about a song to take us out?
Sure. I think you should play one that was kind of touching at leaving a place and coming back. And that's the song Mexico. That came from a place of wanting to leave, just to feel that feeling you get when you come back home. And I think it's important to leave in order to appreciate what you have.
Great. We've been speaking with Sarah Kruger of LANU. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and stay safe, everyone.
You say, let's go down.